You may proceed.
Good morning. Let me add my congratulations first to the others, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Hunter Old. I represent the estate of David Griffin through its executrix, Kimberly Kauser Griffin. I would like to reserve, if I may, 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Mrs. Kauser Griffin, as the court knows, is the widow and surviving spouse of David Griffin. Mr. Griffin was entitled to certain retirement benefits that were granted to him under what was called the Dominion Salaried Savings Plan through his service to Dominion Resources of more than 20 years. It is the funds available, although there were other pension funds available to him, it's the Dominion Salaried Savings Plan funds that are at issue in this particular appeal. We're asking this court to overturn a split decision by the Court of Appeals and to reinstate a memorandum opinion and order of the Circuit Court of Sussex County. The Circuit Court order denies a motion by Mr. Griffin's ex-wife to enter a proposed posthumous order which would have shifted entitlement to the funds available under the Dominion Salary Savings Plan away from Mrs. Kauser Griffin as the surviving spouse and to the children, the grown children of his previous marriage. And this was done through a little bit of an unusual circumstance in that Mrs. Griffin, the ex-wife, asked the court to reinstate and reopen the divorce proceedings that had been closed since 1998. The final decree of divorce incorporated a property settlement agreement entered into in 1996 between the parties, in which Mr. Griffin agreed to name his children as beneficiaries on his 401k and other retirement benefits. And the record below revealed that indeed he had, during the period of time that he was unmarried, had named them as the beneficiaries of his retirement accounts. We believe that the Court of Appeals was incorrect for several different reasons. First, the Court of Appeals ignored specific language in the plan documents themselves that govern the Dominion Salaried Savings Plan.
Mr. Old, let me ask you this one question. In fact, the administrator agreed with you, right?
The plan administrator did, Your Honor. The plan administrator issued an opinion after these proceedings were initiated. Mr. Griffin, on behalf of his client, submitted the proposed posthumous order to the plan, and the plan administrator actually issued a letter opinion saying that they would not consider that domestic relations order a qualified domestic relations order for the reason that it conferred a type or form of benefit that was not otherwise available under the plan documents themselves, which is, again, the first reason we believe that the Court of Appeals was incorrect. We don't believe that the Court of Appeals opinion adequately addresses the language in the plan documents that dictate exactly how the benefits available under that plan are to be distributed.
Well, one of the problems with this case is, isn't it, that there's just one pot of money and the administrator's got to decide who it goes to, whether it goes to the children or it goes to the new wife.
That's correct. And the entire purpose of the Employees Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, what we call ERISA, as it's been amended, is to protect not only the plan participants but their surviving spouses and beneficiaries, their proper beneficiaries.
And one of the theories behind that is that marriage is an economic partnership and that the wife has certain benefits and rights to this money.
That's correct.
And that's part of the salary, exactly.
As may a children or ex-wife. And we acknowledge that that's certainly a possibility. And the statute specifically sets forth the mechanism and the only mechanism by which a plan participant can designate those funds away from what the statute requires and what the plan documents require, which would otherwise be, which is that the surviving spouse is entitled to those documents. That mechanism is what's called a qualified domestic relations order, and that is the form of order that was submitted to the plan administrator and that the plan administrator denied.
What about the provisions that appear to allow them to perfect their quadro a period of time after the death of the plan participant? So the argument here is that the property settlement agreement was not a proper quadro, but it seems that the regulations would allow them to perfect their quadro even after his death.
Madam Justice, the regulations that I believe you're referring to are the Department of Labor interpretation of the Pension Protection Act of 2006. Those regulations, we believe, are inapplicable to this particular situation. That regulation, the example cited by the Court of Appeals, specifically sets out a situation where a participant and a spouse divorce, and an order, a proposed order, is submitted directly to the plan, and then says that no proposed quadro and then after it's submitted, the participant dies, and it says no proposed quadro should be denied solely because of that timing issue. So the example posits a situation where you have submitted an order, then the participant dies, and then there's a decision as to whether that proposed order actually qualifies or not. In this case, there was absolutely no notice whatsoever given to anybody, not to Mrs. Kauser-Griffin, not to the plan administrator. The only thing that exists is the 1996 property settlement agreement, which all parties and all courts agree does not meet the requirements, the statutory requirements for a quadro.
So would your position be different if the former wife had notified the plan administrator, I'm going to file a quadro?
My position would be different if there had been a proposed order submitted, and certainly it would be different if there had been an order that had been approved by the court. But only as to that timing issue. I think what makes this case different, Your Honor, and perhaps I misspoke when I answered your question, I think what also, the second thing that makes this case different is the fact that Ms. Kauser-Griffin is a new wife, if you will. This is not an issue of solely regarding the timing of the issuance of the quadro and the death of the participant. There was a 14-year gap between the date of the final decree and the death of the plan participant in this particular case. And 10 years after the divorce, Mr. Griffin remarried. 6 months after he was married, he was diagnosed with renal cell cancer, and after a prolonged battle with the disease, passed away in 2012. And at no time during that period of time was there any notice given to anybody. But I think probably more importantly, as I'm standing here and trying to answer your question, is that Mrs. Kauser-Griffin became the surviving spouse in the interim. And when she became the surviving spouse, she became entitled to those survivor benefits. And these are survivor benefits. And the fact that it's payable in a lump sum versus an annuitized payment, I think, has very little bearing on the analysis of this case. The plan documents are very clear, and the language in the plan specifically says that federal law requires that if you are married when you die, your spouse must receive the distribution unless she or he approved your choice of another or an additional beneficiary before your death, and your spouse must agree to your choice of that beneficiary by signing the spousal consent portion of a beneficiary authorization form. That form must have been completed, signed, notarized, and returned to the plan administrator before your death. All of that language is contained within the plan documents themselves.
Let me stop you right there. What does this have to do with the applicability of Section 1056, which allows a quadro to take the place of the surviving spouse receiving the benefit?
Just because
that language is in the plan doesn't make 1056 less effective as against that plan, because the law requires it.
That's correct. The language that's contained here is required by the law. But what 1056 does is it does not permit any proposed order, such as this one, to be considered a qualified domestic relations order if it confers a type or form of benefit or an option. That's what the statutory language is, a type or form of benefit or an option that's not contained in the plan documents. So what this proposed order does is it would take a situation where the plan documents require the surviving spouse get paid, and it would provide a different option.
The plan is always going to require the surviving spouse be paid.
The plans, yes, sir.
Yeah, that's always going to be true.
Correct.
So you're saying that a quadro could never be effective.
I am not saying that, no.
Okay.
If the bargain had been in place before Ms. Kauser Griffin, before Mr. Griffin died, and Ms. Kauser Griffin became entitled to those benefits, then it certainly would have been effective.
So it's all about the timing of the quadro.
It is. It's not, Your Honor. If he was unmarried in this case, the timing of the quadro would have very little effect whatsoever. It's the fact that he's married, the fact that those benefits are required to be paid to the surviving spouse under the statute. Under the plan.
Can I stop you? Because I thought you said to me is that if the quadro were there when he married her, it would be fine.
Correct, Your Honor.
But it wasn't. So it's about the timing of the quadro. If the quadro were in place when he married her, you've told me that I thought that means it would be effective.
Yes, Your Honor. The timing, but it is because he's married at the time that he passes away.
Right.
It's not solely an issue of the timing. The timing is one factor. It certainly is one factor. But the statute and the regulations require that it be solely an issue of timing.
Counsel, let me ask you, I'll interrupt you a second if I can. Isn't it about vesting also? And that's what the Fourth Circuit said in Hopkins.
And once correct.
Once he's died, it is now vested in the new wife.
That's what I was trying to say without using, I didn't use the word vested, but that is exactly what I meant, Your Honor.
And the reason you didn't do that is because in Hopkins they were dealing with an annuity. And the vesting of an annuity is different than the payment of a lump sum because, of course, the amounts of the annuity are going to be based upon the life expectancy of the people who receive the annuity.
That is one factor that the Hopkins Court considered, Your Honor, but I would submit that it is not by any means the only factor. And that the Hopkins Court was very clear that it was considering the entire ERISA statute. And it's not simply the recomputation of actuarial tables that is pertinent to the vesting analysis. And that is shown through the cases such as Hurwitz versus Scherr, Ross versus Ross, Langston versus McShane, where you have cases that were a lump sum payment that were also subjected to the vesting analysis that is pertinent to this case as well. There is not a single case, Your Honor, that I have been able to locate where the courts have taken away rights, whether it's lump sum payment or annuitized or any type of plan document. Once those rights have vested in the surviving spouse, there's no situation where a court has taken those rights away and then given them to somebody else. The only cases that deal with posthumous quadros are situations where the plan participant was unmarried at the time that he died, and therefore you're talking about who is the proper beneficiary. The law abhors a vacuum, so we need to figure out who the proper beneficiary is. In this case, there's no question. It's the surviving spouse.
The Court of Appeals talks about other issues, about the domestic relations order failing to comply with the specificity requirements. Is that a separate basis in your favor, or is this all intertwined somehow?
I believe it is all intertwined, Your Honor. The fact that he died while married to Ms. Kauser Griffin vests the survivor benefits, and these are survivor benefits, in her at the time of his death, and therefore entering a posthumous quadro would divest her of those rights and transfer those rights to somebody else. I don't believe that that's permitted under the statute. I have about a minute 36 left. I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal, if I may.
All right. You have 1:32 left.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Roger Griffin, and I do represent the appellant, Ms. Sandra Griffin, in this case, that I think is a case of significance, but one which will have a very limited application moving forward because of the facts that we come to this case in. As Justice Goodwin alluded, this case is very different because it is not an annuity case, as many of the cases that Mr. Old cites in his argument and his prior briefing to this court. The difference in that is that we have, in this case, a lump sum benefit, not an annuity benefit. The Hopkins case that Mr. Old uses as his primary support for his argument very clearly said in footnote number 7, we are dealing with a plan administrator who has to make an actuarial calculation on the day of retirement, and they have to know the age of the person who's receiving the benefits so that that plan annuity can be established at that point. If that person changes after that point, then you very well run into a 1056 problem under 29 U.S.C. 1056. It says a quadro is not going to be qualified if it increases the benefits. So once you do that actuarial calculation and you have a new person come in with a quadro, you're most likely going to run into that 1056 problem. All of that is avoided in this case because it's a lump sum payment, as Justice pointed out. The same amount's going here to Mr. Ohl's client, or the same amount is going to go to the Kauser or the Griffin children who were qualified and who had the first vested rights in this money through the state court order at the final decree stage.
Counsel, one concern I have with what you're talking about, with what your argument is whether it's an annuity or a lump sum, it still comes under the protection of ERISA. And
yes,
as the Supreme Court said in Boggs, one of the reasons for ERISA is to protect the economic security of people who are working and their families.
And Boggs equally said one of the central goals of the Protection Act under REA, the Retirement Equity Act, was to protect former spouses and dependent children. And that's what we're doing here.
Absolutely. But a 401k is just as important as an annuity, isn't it, as far as protecting these rights?
It is, and we're protecting the rights of the dependent children.
So I don't think you should make a distinction between an annuity and a 401k, because, in fact, for one reason is that many of the employers across the country are moving to defined contribution plans and getting away from defined benefit plans because of the cost of them.
Well, we have to make that distinction because of the very real problem of the annuity calculations.
That's one problem, sure. But the other problem is to protect the rights not only of children and prior spouses, but also the new spouse. As we mentioned before, we can go on all day about what the proper equities are in this case. Certainly there are equities on the side of your client, but there's equities on the side of Mr. Ohl's client. And the fact that he was married to this woman for a number of years, she thought she had some interest in this 401k that had been going on for years. And finally, after he dies, if you're correct, she's got no interest.
Well,
so there's equities on both sides. Will you agree with that?
If she felt she had an interest in it, then she was misled by Mr. Griffin, who violated the court order in changing.
Well, he misled his children by not doing what he was supposed to do under the PSA. So he's the wrong party, perhaps, but both of these other two people are innocent, aren't they? The children as well as the new wife?
They are, but if we set this up in its proper scope, as the Ninth Circuit has done, and I think the Ninth Circuit has analyzed this the best possible, because they have both denied it in a situation and granted it in a situation, in the Tice case where they granted it. And in that case,
in Tice, though, they did not address a posthumous quadro that was entered without any notice to the administrator, did they? They said specifically, we're not going to talk about that. That's not a big problem.
But the Files case came out later and said, out of the Third Circuit, the Files case said there is no provision in ERISA that says there has to be on notice, and there's no provision in ERISA that says that the quadro has to be presented. And that's absolutely correct. You cannot glean those statutes any provision that says that they have to both have notice and prior copy of the quadro before death. But in Tice, what they did say was, when Tice dealt with, Mr. Old said that you can't find another case, but Tice dealt with a death benefit and a competing claim to those to that death benefit at the time of death.
Is that an annuity or a...
It was a straight death benefit.
Okay.
And they said, in that case, we have to look at the rights of these two parties who claim to have vested. Mr. Old says his client's right vested and nothing can be done about it at this point. Well, if vesting means nothing can be done about it, then what happened to the rights that vested in my client's children when the state court order came down and said, you will be the beneficiaries of this money? Mr. Old, at one hand, says once it vests, you can't do anything, but oh, by the way, it vested kids and it's gone.
Well, don't you have a problem then with the federal preemption? Because what the federal preemption says is, regardless of what the state law is on domestic relations orders, which is what you're saying vested your rights right here, federal law takes priority. And if it didn't, you'd have the same kind of problem you had in Boggs, where in that case, the ex-wife actually prepared a will that allowed her children to inherit benefits. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not allowed under ERISA.
But the preemption problem is all ameliorated through 1144 that says preemption does not apply to quadros, and that quadros are going to be an exception to
the
health.
But you still get to the problem of when was a quadro entered. And the argument is going to be, is a posthumous quadro allowed or not?
Yes, and there's no law that
says no case one way or the other.
There's no case that says you can't do it, and we have the Code of Federal Regulations in 2006 that came out to support the PPA of that year that say, regardless of timing, even after death,
but they don't talk about specifically about the case that we have here today, do they? Where there's a new spouse that is apparently vested or arguably vested.
They do not. But if you look at the way that this works, under 1056, a person can be granted rights, just as Mrs. Kauser Griffin would argue. A person can be granted rights. The plan administrator, when presented with a quadro, has a period of 18 months. And this quadro was submitted within that 18-month period. During that 18 months, the plan administrator's obligations are to segregate the funds And if the quadro is presented during that 18-month qualifies, the plan administrator pays the quadro beneficiary. If there's no decision made in that 18 months, or if the quadro doesn't qualify, the plan administrator pays the other interested person who is interested in the funds. But what's significant about that is, after that 18-month period, if the quadro has not been determined during the 18 months, but is determined after the 18 months to be qualified, then the plan administrator must pay all prospective benefits to the person entitled under the quadro.
Well, let me ask you about that. Now, let's say, though, the day after Mr. Griffin died, the plan administrator paid the entire amount of money to his new wife.
Well, in this
case, 401k was paid completely to her. What would happen then?
In this case, we would just be practically out of luck. But for purposes of ERISA, what it was saying is, if it's not a lump sum payment, if there are payments over time, and one person gets it under the ERISA statutes, but then you have a quadro submitted even 18 months after the qualifying event, which would have been Mr. Griffin's death in this case, then all of a sudden the quadro person prevails for all prospective payments. So the concept of a final vesting under ERISA is not a concept that's proper. You never vest finally under ERISA.
So can the plan administrator never pay the money out on a 401k? Because at any time, you've said there's no time when you have to file a quadro. So if you wait 10 years later, can they file a quadro?
At 18 months, they pay.
Does that have anything to do with 401ks, or is that just about annuities, the 18 months?
No, it's any time that there's an ERISA type of plan. At 18 months, they pay it if there's not a quadro. But if a quadro pops up after 18 months and there's still money to pay, they have to pay the quadro beneficiary.
So it's sort of a, if you pay it, you're okay, but if you don't pay it, then you might have to pay it to somebody else? Is that the way you're saying it works?
It's all for the protection of, again, the ideas were for the uniform schemes for the protection of the plan administrator. So, yes, after 18 months, the plan administrator could say, my job is clear. I pay the participant under the plan.
So an example I gave you, the plan administrator could have paid everything the next day to Mrs. Kowser Griffin, and he'd been okay.
Well, right now they have the Court of Appeals opinion that prevents them from doing that, and they had put the money on administrative hold.
I understand that.
During that 18-month period they did that. So for our purposes,
doesn't it concern you that the easy way to solve this thing is just to file the quadro on time?
It is, absolutely, and that would have cured it. But what we're saying today, and what I hope that this court acknowledges, is that very limited application that we're going to have in this case is when prior state court rights vest. And many of the cases that Mr. Old cites don't have that in there. When those prior state court rights vest, and when it is proper to submit a quadro, which this one has, all the 1056 provisions, you can't look at that and say that it disqualifies for any reason. But when you can present a proper quadro, even after death, and you have a prior state court right that is vested, then you need to do the right thing and honor those vested rights. Even though there may be a competing claim, and even though it may come after 18 months, if there's payments that are still available for payment, they need to go to the proper person under the quadro.
And that's what is your position about the dissent's observation that this domestic relations order didn't qualify to be a quadro in the first place because of the lack of specificity? And if that's the case, the posthumous nature of it all is fascinating, the lack of notice is fascinating, but there's not a quadro here.
Well, Chief Justice, that's exactly right, and I didn't argue that point. What happens in many of these cases where you have problems entering a subsequent quadro is they try to argue, well, but look at the prior court orders, and maybe one of those qualified as a quadro, and so we don't have to have a posthumous one. We can go back to and support it with one of the prior ones. I can't argue that the prior final decree can properly constitute a quadro. We need this quadro entered now after death in order to, but it is properly
so qualified. You understand the dissent to be saying that unless there's a posthumous quadro, you can't find an order in the case itself that would qualify, and consequently, the trial court was right. That's the position of the dissent.
Well, the trial court was wrong because they didn't let us use this quadro posthumously.
Well, I understand that's your position. I'm just saying I'm trying to understand the dissent's position. I think
the dissent's position is you can't have a posthumous quadro.
That's right.
That's
in the paragraphs before, and consequently, if you look to find another order there, none of them qualify anyway. That's what the dissent
said. Right. But there is no case authority to support the fact that you can't have a posthumous quadro. In fact, the CFRs speak to that fact. They clearly say the posthumous quadros are permitted, and that's done to illustrate
the CFRs. But what we will have here, Justices,
is there a distinction to be drawn that Justice Millett drew between a quadro that is entered when there is no surviving spouse? All of the examples appear to address a situation where there is a surviving, where there is not a surviving spouse.
Is there a distinction to be made because
yes.
of the surviving spouse? Well, there certainly is, because we wouldn't have Mr. Orr arguing on the behalf of anybody else, I don't think, at this point. So it does make it more complicated with that competing claim. But as I point out, and as the Ninth Circuit did in the Henry Gendro case, and in Tice, and they even alluded to it in Carmona, I believe it was. It was the other Ninth Circuit case. It was not Carmona. When you have that surviving spouse, the prior DRO doesn't give you the enforceability. It gives you the right. The quadro is only there to give you the enforceability of it. So where one might argue, well, you've got these two competing interests, and how do we satisfy those competing interests? Because at worst, under Gendro, the court appropriately said, you know what happens is, when a state court order is entered, that limits that person's rights to do anything else with those funds. The rights were at that time vested under the law of this court. Those rights were vested in the children. How then does Mr. Griffin have any rights to do anything further with those funds? They've already gone out the door.
Well, one thing, you hit one of the real problems in this case. One of the problems, unlike most property settlement agreements, this one not only divided up marital property, but it also divided up all his future 401k. And so what you've done by not filing this quadro till after he dies is you've taken money away from his new wife that she was entitled to under the plan, and apparently not to her knowledge that it was going to be taken away. Isn't that a problem?
Just for clarity purposes, Mrs. Griffin was pro se during this action, and so there was no counsel's assistance to help her with this, and it's a very, as we can all understand, it's a very tedious process dealing with quadros and with ERISA. And I think, to give her the benefit of the doubt, this is not a typical quadro benefit where it's a portion of a payment plan going out that you actually need a quadro to tell the plan administrator, when you start making that payment, make it here and make it there. This was a benefit that Mr. Griffin could have kept in place and never needed a quadro to do anything with had he never changed the beneficiary form and had he told his new wife, you're going to need to sign this consent because I have to keep these funds to my kids. My final decree requires me to give these funds to my kids, and you, my new spouse, stand in the way of me being able to do that. You, my new spouse, keep putting me in contempt of court. You, my new spouse, need to sign this consent so I'm not in contempt of court for doing it. And so because of that, this is a different type of case where a quadro wouldn't ordinarily come to mind of saying, I got to tell the plan administrator to send that money to me. Because as long as my name's on that line and my kids' names are on that line, I'm okay. The plan administrator looks at those lines and says he's okay. So
I doubt if that's a standard of care in domestic relations these days. I think now the standard of care is you've got to do that quadro.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Sure. And that's one thing that this case is going to make perfectly clear to all the practitioners in the state is you got to do it, you got to do it on time. But what
exactly.
I'm saying is not doing it on time in this case, it's better to. But it's not the death knell. Because this window that is open for somebody who has prior vested rights and for an annuity that is still got some payment left in it that hasn't been paid out even after the 18 months. Then the funds are available, and then the funds can be used. And under 1056, it completely complies with all the 1056 requirements. There's no regulation against a posthumous quadro, and there's nothing that the court can point to other than the fact that there's a surviving spouse out there claiming, hey, me too. But as I said, her rights long went out down the drains when Mr. Griffin signed over those rights to the kids. I respectfully ask the court to uphold the Court of Appeals' opinion.
All right, rebuttal. You have a minute 32.
And I have a couple things to take issue with. The first is the statement that this order, the property settlement agreement, requires Mr. Griffin to give these benefits to his kids. Actually, as I said in the opening, the specific language in the order is that he would name his children as beneficiaries on these plans. And the evidence before the trial court was that indeed he did until the time that he remarried. I think, although Mr. Griffin certainly isn't here to explain why, I think that perhaps gives some indication that he understood exactly what he was agreeing to at the time, and that is while he was unmarried, he did properly designate his children as beneficiaries with the understanding that if he got married again in the future, perhaps those benefits would go someplace else. Again, we're dealing with a situation
where... Can you show me Show me where, what in the joint appendix, give me a page to put my finger on that supports that statement you just made.
Unfortunately, the joint appendix does not contain a copy of the property settlement agreement. The language that I'm referring to is, however, specifically quoted in the memorandum opinion found on page 284 of the joint appendix. In Judge Sherritt's memorandum opinion, it is the very bottom of the first paragraph under the facts section. Under the terms of that same agreement, the parties further agreed to, quote, name the children of the marriage as co-beneficiaries under all 401k plans and other such plans which would be distributed upon the death by the party. That's the specific language that I'm referring to. It was in the court record. This is a motion to reinstate the divorce proceedings from 1998, and it was that divorce proceeding.
Where does it say, though, that the obligation that was vested in the property settlement agreement went away when he got remarried?
Well, Your Honor, the question of vesting is a completely, I think, a separate question for the state rights, because at the time that
we're a state court. The property settlement agreement vested when it became a final decree for purposes of state law, did it not?
Except where it conflicts with the federal law, which has an anti-alienation provision.
I understand that part. But where, and for some reason the property settlement agreement isn't in our joint appendix, where in this memorandum opinion does it say that the children's rights go away when he gets remarried? You just made that as an affirmative statement of fact, and I want to know where's the support for it.
The support is in the plan documents themselves, Your Honor, which
you have not put in the record.
No, the plan documents are in the record. The plan documents specifically say that the surviving spouse must be paid the benefits upon the death of the beneficiary.
I think I can answer that. Can I ask a question? In fact, once he remarried, he had no longer any authority to name the children as beneficiaries because the anti-alienation provisions of ERISA require that the only way that can happen is if his new wife consents to it.
That's what I was trying to say, and I apparently was not saying it clearly. Thank you.
Because the statute says if there's a quadro, there is alienation.
Absolutely, but absent a quadro, he can't do that, right?
And there was no quadro in this case at the time of death. Ms. Kauser Griffin became entitled to those benefits under the plan documents at that time, and to enter a quadro now, posthumously, would take those rights away from her and give them to the children and place the state law rights conferred under the property settlement agreement.
Well, we know that. And not to do it takes the rights away from the children that they had under the divorce decree.
The federal statute requires the preemption of those state rights.
The position is that it may have vested under state law. It's just not enforceable in the face of ERISA.
It's not enforceable because there was no quadro, and Mrs. Kauser Griffin's federal rights then interfere with the enforceability of those state rights. And under the preemption doctrine of Section 1144, the federal right takes precedence.
Well, let me ask you this. Doesn't it really come down to whether or not you can have a posthumous quadro? Because all those arguments that you just made are accepted if there was a quadro in place.
I would argue, Justice, that's not a complete statement. The question is whether a posthumous quadro can be entered if there's a surviving spouse entitled to those same benefits.
Right.
And that's what we have here. I think if there was no surviving spouse, if Mr. Griffin was unmarried at the time of death, your question is answered in the affirmative with no problem.
Right.
Whatsoever.
And you're saying if there's a surviving spouse, then it's answered in a negative.
Correct.
Right. But that's the question.
Yes, sir. I don't understand your question to include the surviving spouse aspect of it,
right.
But yes.
Well, I think you have a very interesting case, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chief. Thank you for your time.
Call the next case.